And we'll now ask our Brother Brian to come forward and to speak to the subject, the City of Yahweh.
Dear Brother Philip and my dear brothers and sisters and dear young people, there's no question about Isaiah chapter 60. It's a chapter of crescendo upon Zion. If there is a great chapter in the Bible about Zion, and there's many, there's no question that Isaiah 60 is really the ultimate expression of that. It's a Zionist's happy hunting ground, so to speak. It's just full of the most majestic pictures, one upon another, and a greater length than any other passage in the rest of the Bible. So it makes it very precious to us, doesn't it? Isaiah chapter 60, a chapter about Jerusalem, a crescendo chapter that has so many varied pictures of exaltation, of glory and majesty, of peace and serenity, satisfaction, joy, light. God is there. It's got the whole scene. It just expands it and expands it. And really the challenge of the chapter, because we know the words pretty well, the challenge of the chapter is to try and take that all in. Because what we tend to do is read a verse, and that's the verse. But really, that's not how it was given. There's a whole kaleidoscope of information there that's calling upon our imagination, upon our love of Jerusalem. It's calling upon us, God is calling upon us, to try and fill that picture out in our minds and to live in it. That's why it's given. It's not given just for information. It's not just resting in the page for a bit of information, a few facts. Because tomorrow it wants us to go to our work or be in our homes, our schools, or whatever we're doing. And God wants us to see that picture and be driven by that picture. And that's why he sketched scene after scene of its beauty. Some things will appeal to us more than others. But see if we can tonight, and it is a big challenge, a very big challenge, see if we can actually build that picture in our minds and see all the facets. Go home talking about it, the thrill of it, the joy of it, so that tomorrow is another day. In the sixth and seventh verses, we had what we called the acceptance of the East, where all those people of the East were coming, many of whom now have been very antagonistic towards Israel. King Saud used to say, and the king that followed him in Saudi Arabia, that his ultimate dream was that he could come to Jerusalem to pray. Remember, he often used to say that? And so they considered, as Mohammedans, that they had a very real stake in Jerusalem. All my dear brothers and sisters, they haven't got any stake in Jerusalem as far as the promises of God are concerned. And but there is a time when they will come. And these beautiful verses, 6 and 7, speak of that time when the children of the East will come, and they'll come with their offerings, verse 7, from their flocks, and they will be accepted upon mine altar, it says in verse 7, and I will glorify the house of my glory. So God is there and these people are there. Should they really be there? There's no question about whether they're there rightly, because God says, and I will glorify the house of my glory. Arabs they might be, but they'll come in the right spirit. They shall show forth the praises of Yahweh. Like the Queen of Sheba came, and she was just out of breath, wasn't she, when she saw what Solomon had done, and she saw his ministers, and saw the ascent by which he went up unto the house of Yahweh. There was no breath left in her. She must have been a passionate woman, mustn't she? And you know, many of those people are. Brought to the right things, and to see things as they really are, according to God's purpose, according to the God of Israel. They don't even know him. They don't think he is. But when they see that and see it aright, there will be passion and feeling in those people. And they will come and do as she did in days of old. And he will glorify the house of his glory in their praises as well. But in verses 8 and 9, we're not looking to the east, we're looking to the west. We're looking to the west because it says in verse 9, that there are ships of Tarshish, bringing thy sons from far. Do you remember last week we We mentioned in verse 8 that this seems to refer to these people that were coming, not from the east but from the west. And they were coming because it was home, as pigeons. When they're taken sometimes many miles from their home, they will find their way home, called homing pigeons or doves. And there's no question in my mind at all, that's the sense of verse 8. These people have been away a long time, caged, now liberated from all the things which in many cases they had self-enslaved themselves. But now they're liberated and they're coming. Who are these that fly as a cloud? There's no restraints. Remember last time we were saying that when you see the gracious movement of the clouds, it is majestic, isn't it? It's wondrous. You can't see what's driving them, but swiftly and unerringly and beautifully they flow across the heavens. Well, in some sort of similar way, perhaps the prophet was standing at the headland, as it were, the headland that looked toward the west, and he sees these ships coming, blowing along, as he would see it, with their sails in full bloom, and driven because of God's determination to bring them to the land. The very winds are right to bring them. It says it is the ships of Tarshish in verse 9 that will be bringing them to that place. The ships of Tarshish shall wait for me. You know, in history, this passage has had a very significant outworking. If you turn to Psalm 72, there's another passage. I want you to link these two. They're obviously very similar. But these two passages have actually had a lot to do with the history of the 20th century. In Psalm 72, we have a similar passage. It says there, speaking of the worldwide dominion of Christ, the Son of David, the kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Yea, all kings shall fall down before him, all nations shall serve him. Now you notice that Tarshish is mentioned and the kings of Sheba and Seba. That's a very similar picture to what you've got in the enlarged statements in Isaiah 60. In Isaiah 60, the kings of the east are mentioned first and Tarshish after. But isn't it interesting that both of them are mentioned in Psalm 72 and the thought is expounded here in Isaiah chapter 60. It was these two passages in the wartime cabinet, British wartime cabinet, in 1914 to 1917, that influenced the British cabinet to do what they did as far as the Balfour Declaration is concerned. And even before that, for a period of something like, 50 or 60 years, perhaps even a little longer than that, but not much longer, there had been a growing awareness that the scriptures said considerable about Israel returning to their land. Now, the view of the British people in that the view of the British people was that the Jewish people should by then be converted. Here they were scattered in other lands. Now we open our doors to them, we convert them, and then we take them back to the land. Of course, that wasn't quite right, was it? A redeemer shall come to Zion and turn ungodliness from Jacob. And they weren't the redeemer. It was going to be a post-adventual conversion of Israel that would bring them as an enlightened people. But, noted Dr. Thomas, whilst that was true, there would be a partial and primary restoration of the Jews before the advent. And he could see that because of, what was the passage? It was Ezekiel 38, wasn't it? Because he saw there that there was a people that had been returned to their land and they were doing well. Messiah was not there. That's clear because the invasion occurs after that. But he nevertheless could see that they had gotten goods and become quite wealthy and influential in the navel of the earth, as he describes it in Ezekiel, before the advent of Christ. It wasn't Brother Thomas a marvellous man? He really was. You know, we ought to really treasure our heritage. There is not another people in all the world that had that so clearly expounded as what Christadelphians had. And you know, I say with all my heart, when you hear people belittling this, step back and walk away from it, because my dear brothers and sisters, we really have had something very, very special. Dr. Thomas got that absolutely right. Absolutely right. And because of this passage and other passages, he, you know, knew more than the British cabinet. They thought it was, you know, the honour of the British people. Now we'll go out and we'll bring the Jews back to the land and we'll establish them back on that land and they'll be converted to us. And he was wrong. They weren't going to be converted. Dr. Thomas came along and looked at the Bible more correctly and said, Britain will do a work. This passage in the future says she'll do a work. But how was the doctor able to say that Britain was able to bring them and help them to develop their land before the coming of Christ? It's an astonishing statement. I know not what the British statesman might think at this time, he wrote. It matters not a rush what they think or what they design. The time will come when it will be politically expedient to do that, and they will hasten to do what God says they will do. And they did. Page 442 in Helpus Israel. Now that's our heritage. Young people, hear that? Don't you ever tell me you can't read Helpus Israel or you can't understand Eureka. Don't you ever tell me that, or I'll grab out of your bag what you're learning at school and all the things you have to learn if you do a course at university or some other place. And they're 10 times harder than reading Eureka. What a lot of nonsense. You can't read Eureka. It's just a matter of our desire to read it, isn't it? And don't let any of our young people be put off by somebody that says it's too hard. Nonsense. If it's some other thing, we'll struggle like mad to get it. And we've got to be very, very clear-minded, I think, about the blessings we've had. This passage reminds us of all of that. We've had a very wonderful heritage indeed. So it says here that the ships of Tarshish will be first in bringing Israel back to the land at that time. What we in fact saw in 1917 through to 1948 was a sort of prototype of that, wasn't it? When they brought back the Jewish people, well, because of a shamed conscience, I would say, the world was absolutely ashamed of what they found had happened in World War II and the years that had led up to it. Of course, there will be, before Tarshish does that, some humiliation of Tarshish. And another psalm makes that plain. Psalm 48. It's an interesting thing too, isn't it, that Tarshish was understood by such a wide range of Bible students. If you went out in the streets today or in the churches today and asked somebody that knew anything about Tarshish, they'd think you're off your rocker. Who's Tarshish? But there was a whole body of Bible students familiar with those passages and had reasoned upon them. What a wonderful thing that was. God no doubt brought that about, that that would happen as he said it would. Psalm 48, verse 7. Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish with an east wind. As we have heard, so have we seen in the city of Yahweh of hosts, in the city of our God, God will establish it forever. So after the breaking of the pride of the British people, they will then come to see this honoured role. And no doubt they'll pick up the Bible again and it'll be explained to them. It's been said a long time that this is what you're going to do. And they'll want to do it. They'll want to do it. The isles shall wait for me and the ships of Tarshish first to bring thy sons from far. So they're going to be willing servants on behalf of God's people to bring them back to that land. The expectations of the Jewish people will be fulfilled, as this little section, verses 8 to 9, It can be summarised.
Expectations
fulfilled. And you know, they don't come back like they came back before. You remember those, I'm sure most of us probably read the book Exodus. Remember the old vessels on which they came. Whatever was left after World War II had bombed everything out of the waters. Old freighters that could hardly float in the water, had no maintenance, and they brought back a decrepit people, a broken people, a miserable, unhealthy, broken people. One where was a family of 100 before. That's how they came back. Wretched and miserable and desperate. Desolate. They won't come back like that. They'll come back as thy sons. From wherever they are, thy sons from far. Their silver and their gold with them. You know, there was a ship at the beginning of World War II, around the year 1940, when there were many Jews that escaped from Europe. And there was a ship, I believe it had 100,000 Jewish people on board. Does anybody else remember that story? Can you confirm? It was some very large number. Wasn't that number, Sharon? Well, that might be why it never got there. Was it 40,000? 48,000? It was a very large number of people, and it was a very notable book. Was it the... It's the St. Louis, I think you might be right. I was going to say the Missouri, but that was Pearl Harbor. Yes, I think it was the St. Louis. They travelled across the Atlantic looking for a place, contacted Britain, They went up along the South American coast looking for a place, These people had no one left where they came from. Whatever had been their families was in the gas chambers, by now, ashes and smoke. And these people came from that circumstance and they knocked on America's doors. And Roosevelt said, sorry. And they turned back and went across the Atlantic again. And they came to Britain. Britain said, sorry, a second time. Until finally they found their way into some of these smaller countries of Europe and some into Britain and so on. Isn't this a different story, eh? What a totally different story. No old ragtag ship that's bringing them, you know, against to a foe that's in the land, to a friend that's now turned to foe, had her soldiers in the land to stop them coming up the beaches of the Mediterranean. That's what they did. They stopped them, they arrested them, put them into prison. Don't you dare come back here. Who do you think you are to come to this place? We're going to make this for Arabs. And that was British policy towards the end. Look what a difference has happened in verse 9. Not inhibited now by the sea, by land forces of an occupying power, but that power has been converted. Coming home with style, as it were, and with thanksgiving, these people want to come. What are they coming for? They're coming with the silver and their gold with them unto the name of Yahweh thy God and to the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee. They've heard of good things in the land and they want to come. You know, this is a powerful passage in verse 9. Do you know, many people in recent times, Jewish people, have had the opportunity to come and didn't want to come. We've heard, haven't we, about the Russian Jews that finally found a way out. Almost as though in God's hand it was like that. And they came into Austria and they found their visas and so forth to go to whatever land they would like to go to. And you would have thought they'd just clamour to go to Israel after all the drama of it. Oh no, some came, indeed. Some came. But you know, the majority of them went west to the good lands, lands of silver and gold. They didn't want dust and stones and Palestinians. They wanted good land. They wanted peace and security. They weren't going to fight for this. But you see, now they feel differently. They come, this is the reason they come, unto the name of Yahweh thy God. They couldn't care a fig for New York, but they love Yahweh of Israel, their God. What a different thing that is. What a beautiful statement. To the Holy One of Israel. Not just because they're Jews as of a nation, but because of the Holy One of Israel, they've come to see again and to own that Yahweh is the God of Israel, and he has done wondrous things for them. He hath glorified them. And they don't come empty-handed. They come with their silver and their gold with them. And yet, you know, it's that very silver and gold today that stops them from coming. Vast sections of the world economy today are actually controlled, monitored, owned, whatever, by the Jewish people. There's no question about that. Even in Australia, look at the top 100 men in terms of wealth, and it's astounding to see the number of Jewish names there. What do you think it's like in New York? Brooklyn has something like 2 million, 2.5 million Jews. Can you imagine if they own a few things? Just imagine that. Centre of the Western world's economic power, and it's just stacked with Jews. And all those tall buildings that run the shares and the money issues and so forth, it's an enormous thing. Well, they wanted to come now to Jerusalem, not because they happened just to be Jews, but because of the name of Yahweh their God. To the Holy One of Israel. No longer do they want to be up there fighting away to get more and more wealth of this present world and tricking and laying all kinds of plans to their own advantage as they've done. They just can't help themselves. Now they want to go to Jerusalem because of the Holy One of Israel, because he hath glorified thee, which of course is Jerusalem. Very beautiful things indeed. You know, it says in Jeremiah chapter 3 concerning Jerusalem and the name of God, that God's name will be there. At that time, in verse 17 of chapter 3, they shall call Jerusalem the throne of Yahweh, and all the nations shall be gathered unto it to the name of Yahweh. Where is the name of Yahweh? It's in Jerusalem. To be gathered unto it to the name of Yahweh to Jerusalem. At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of Yahweh. That's why they're coming. It's not just because it's a lovely place and it's got a nice climate or there's better economic advantages. It's because God has settled himself in that city and they've come to love their God. What a beautiful thing that is. Very beautiful thing. I don't know if you know many Jewish people, but they are a passionate people. Even in the land, through all the things they've been, there's still nevertheless a very deep passion in the Jewish people. And when this happens, it's going to be exciting to see it. They can really feel situations and a depth of mind to feel that situation, which is, in some of our experiences, very compelling indeed. And that's what we're going to see when this expectation of verses 8 and 9 is fulfilled. They will come to the place where Yahweh's name is, for he will have glorified Jerusalem. And they will hear about that. And they will just be dying to get there. Then in the following bracket of verses, very interesting verses, 10 to 14, we might summarise them under the heading, The Nations Serve Zion. And verse 12 is the core of that section. It begins by telling us in verse 10 that the sons of strangers shall build up thy walls. Sons of strangers shall build up thy walls. Isn't there enough Jewish workmen to do the job? Well, in Psalm 102, it tells us that God is the architect of that rebuilding. Ezekiel gives us a plan of it, doesn't he? In his 40th to 48th chapters. But in Psalm 102, it tells us that God is the architect of that rebuilding. It says in Psalm 102, verse 15, so the heathen shall fear the name of Yahweh, and all the kings of the earth thy glory, when Yahweh shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory. So whatever happens there, it doesn't happen just because we've got good workmen. It happens because God is the architect of that redesign. You know, it's our privilege to have some concept of that. I don't say that I think that we've got every last detail about that. I don't. I don't think that Ezekiel provides every last detail at all. But nevertheless, sufficient is given and sketched to us that we have an impression that's very beautiful and something we never want to let go of. That's what's happened to the churches. If they had taken Ezekiel seriously and saw that God was the architect of a rebuilding of Jerusalem, which the Bible is teaching, they would never be in the spot they're in today, would they? And the Pope would never be clamouring to do what he can in what he calls the present kingdom of God. He would say, there's no point in that. Christ is coming to rebuild Jerusalem. That's the kingdom of God. But he doesn't have that picture. And at the core of that picture is a vision of Jerusalem. At the core of that. And there we see that temple. It's a very important. Let go of that and one thing after the other will slide. Until we be a people as visionless as the Christians, unfortunately, around us. They've let the picture slide. In Zechariah chapter 1, it tells us that, you know, when this happens, God is going to really be involved. He wants to be involved. His passions are to be involved. In Zechariah chapter 1, a delightful passage, verses 12, then the angel of Yahweh answered and said, O Yahweh of hosts, how long wilt thou have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years? And Yahweh answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. So the angel that communed with me said unto me, cry thou, saying, thus saith Yahweh of hosts. He's communicated with God. He's got a message back from God, and this is the message. I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy, the place of rocks and stones and bombs and every kind of violence today. This is what the living God thinks about that place. Be careful, Palestinians. I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. Now look at verse 16. Therefore thus saith Yahweh, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith Yahweh of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry it to saying, thus saith Yahweh of hosts the builder, my cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and Yahweh shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. Jerusalem and its house and the cities around are his, he says. Do you notice that? All those cities were spoken of as his cities. And you know, they're the very things that are up for debate today. Palestinian says they're our cities. And don't you dare have a settlement there, Jewish people. That's God's reply to that. I am very jealous for Jerusalem. So he's going to be involved as the architect and the personage of zeal and power that's going to see that. Now what a lovely thing that is. Therefore not up for debate, is it? It's going to happen. Because his whole thrust of the living God of Israel is behind that. And it will surely come to pass. But there is a prototype, isn't there? There are sons of strangers building up thy walls. And that helps us a little bit to get the picture. Come back then to the days of David. In the first of Chronicles. Funny thing, isn't it, to have people come into your country to build up something which is yours, so to speak. We see it's not just Israel's, is it? In the first of Chronicles 22, when David knew where the house was going to be built, the very next verse tells us, 1 Chronicles 22 and verse 2, that David commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel. And he sent masons to hew wrought stones to build the house of God. He didn't think that was... He just thought that was a natural thing to do.
He commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel. It's the first thing he thought to do, to put them to work about preparing the materials for the house. And so in the Second of Chronicles, we see that his son expanded that sense. The Second of Chronicles chapter 2 and verse 17. It says, "And Solomon numbered all the strangers that were in the land of Israel, after the numbering wherewith David his father had numbered them. And they were found," what a number, "150,000 and 3,600. And he set 70,000 on them to be bearers of burdens, and 80,000 to be hewers in the mountains, bringing the cedars of Lebanon down, and 3,600 overseers to set the people at work." Isn't that an amazing concept? That's how David saw it. That's how Solomon saw it. And the number involved in David's preparation seems, from this record, to be something similar to the number which Solomon employed here. Well, what an incredible contrast that is to what you've got in the world today. If you were to offer the nations, to, especially those that are round about Israel, to come and do a work of building in Israel, you wouldn't have too many volunteers, would you? They'd come with loaded pockets with hand grenades to blow the place apart, but they certainly wouldn't be inclined. What an astonishing statement verse 10 is then, that people wanted to come, and they will come, to build up the Zion's walls. You know, just when Israel, after the war, came back and they established those little kibbutzim and so forth around Israel, do you know there was a turn of heart with a lot of people. Quite a few young people from America and other places actually went to Israel and worked there on the kibbutz. Had some knowledge, no doubt, of the Bible in most cases. And they thought, well, it'd be really good to get in there and plant a few trees and pick a few peaches and reap a crop of wheat on behalf of Israel. Many of them went there without wages, just for the sheer experience of seeing the promised land bud forth again. So it's interesting. Well, in a much greater way, verse 10 will be fulfilled. In fact, furthermore, says that their kings shall minister unto thee. So we can see there, there's Japan's royal family up there with trowel and cement and working on a few of the stones. Something like that picture is thus being described. You could hardly imagine such a thing today. But that's what it's saying. Their kings shall minister unto thee. Remember when Jerusalem was built in the days of Nehemiah, and we were discussing it at our camp, and we saw there that in fact the Rechabites took a section, foreigners took a section and wanted to build. This, I believe, is exactly the same sentiment. Precisely the same sentiment. They've seen the picture, they know that God is in that place, they can see what his son has done for the world and is doing, and they want to be joined to them. They're responding to that. Give me a job. Oh, that I might touch the work and have some role in this wonderful work that's being done. That, I believe, is the sentiment. It doesn't seem to be sort of coercion, but God has turned all the favour of the world towards Jerusalem. What a wonderful thing. It could only be done, couldn't it, by the specific act of God. That will never happen in Gentile times. Israel only has to get up just a little bit and the resentments come. You can feel it all around the world today. Just this last week in Melbourne, there was a man thought to be Jewish, and he went to apply to the Melbourne Club, which is sort of, you know, the aristocracy, as it were, of Melbourne, the big shots, and he was rejected. But before he was rejected, he was asked by several of the committee members if he was Jewish. That's in Melbourne. It's got the largest Jewish population of any city in Australia. So those sentiments aren't far away from the surface at any time. So this is like the Queen of Sheba. She came, she ministered in a different way, didn't she? She wasn't building walls, but she came with her arms full, her caravan of good things that she brought for Solomon. And she couldn't do enough. She was overcome. And again, Psalm 72, we're reminded of Psalm 72.
and verse 10 and 11. There's lots of comparisons with Psalm 72. The kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Yea, all kings shall fall down before him. All nations shall serve him. That's a very similar passage to what we have here. In the 52nd chapter of Isaiah, and verse 15, we have another reference there to the kings of the earth and their response. This is really what has brought them to this position. It says in verse 15 of chapter 52, so shall he, that is Messiah, the suffering servant, so shall he sprinkle many nations. The kings shall shut their mouths at him. In other words, they're speechless. They're just completely overcome. They're in the presence of someone altogether greater. They have no word to offer, for that which had not been told them shall they see. That which they had not heard shall they consider. Whatever they knew about Christianity, that there was a Son of God involved and he made offering, is now going to come home with tremendous force to all peoples. There's hardly a person in the world hasn't heard at least that much about Christianity. And when they see him in Jerusalem and know of his presence, they're going to know that that ancient worldwide fact of the Bible is true. There's the obvious evidence of it. So, going on then in Isaiah 60, it says, for in my wrath I smote thee, but in my favour have I had mercy on thee. This is God speaking, of course, 2,600 years before the fulfilment of these things. In my wrath I smote thee, but as surely as I did that, is what the verse is saying, as surely as those things came upon you, in my favour have I had mercy on thee. As certain as that, as certain as this. If you find verse 10, amazing things. Well, says God, the explanation is that as I said I would smite and I did, so I have said I will have mercy and I will have mercy. And things you never dreamt of will happen. That's what he's saying, isn't it? My word is true. I am a father. You know, that's what a father does do, isn't he? He doesn't just hand out the good things all the time. He has expectations with his children. Scriptures say that he that loveth his child chasteneth him betimes. Don't forget that as parents. He that loveth his child. Why is that? Does a parent love to hit his child? Of course he doesn't love to hit his child. But he loves the things of God more than anything else. And those principles of God he will stand by. And if his child that he loves so tenderly, or mother loves so tenderly, if that child will break those things, then in loyalty to God, that child will buckle under to what God says. Eventually in time, of course, he will do it out of his own heart. But that's how God acts. He could have said, Israel, I love you, okay, with Abraham's children, oh, all right, it's okay, I'll have you on any terms. He didn't say that. In his wrath I struck him, as the Hebrew means. But in my favour I will have mercy upon him. It's a balanced thing, isn't it? Very balanced. Always balanced. Things of God are balanced. They savour of wisdom at every time. Let's never forget those things. Verse 11, whereas verse 10 is spoken about walls, verse 11 is speaking about gates. And it says, therefore thy gates shall be open continually. The reason they're open continually is that they shall not be shut day nor night, that men may bring unto thee the forces of the Gentiles, and that their kings may be brought. And the sense seems to be that there's so many coming. There's not just the odd Queen of Sheba, but the worshippers doing homage to the king of Jerusalem and coming to see Zion are so many that you've got to have the place open all the time. They're coming from all different places of the world.
And they're coming in such numbers that they can bring, therefore, their presence, their forces means their wealth. They can bring them at any time because it's open all the time. In Revelation chapter 21, there's many, many comparisons. One little exercise when you get home tonight. Some of you young married couples that like to have a few minutes to talk over something when you get home. Here's a little exercise. Revelation chapter 21 presents a picture of the New Jerusalem. The exercise would be, go through our chapter in Isaiah 60. On one side, pick out the little features there that you'll find in Revelation chapters 21 and 22. It's a beautiful little exercise. I could put it all there on a board and you wouldn't do the exercise. But if it's left to you, you'll get much more enjoyment out of it. It's a lovely exercise. Here's one. Revelation 21, verse 24. The nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honour unto it. And the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there shall be no night there. They shall bring the glory and honour of the nations into it, and there shall in no wise enter into it anything that defileth. So there's an obvious cross quotation, at least in the sense of it. And as we said, the purpose is that it's open continually so that men may bring unto thee the wealth of the Gentiles. What Jerusalem must be like when all of this happens, eh? There's all these celebrated gifts, this surfeit of good things being brought to Jerusalem. Who would use all those things, do you think? What would those things be used for? Gold and silver, to beautify the place of God's name? There must be some people that come to Jerusalem, but going to be from poorer lands. There will be the priesthood. The Levites are going to be brought back into their priesthood, the family of Aaron and so on. So there's going to be need for sustenance, as there was in former days. But then verse 12, which is the core of this section, says in emphatic language, as the centre of this section, this stanza, for the nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Yea, those nations shall be utterly wasted. It's the core statement. You remember what it says about Egypt in Zechariah chapter 14. She might think that she doesn't have to come up because she doesn't need rain. God has said, if you don't come up, there'll be no rain. If you're not going to bring your presence to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles and celebrate the abundance that I have given you in your land, then there'll be no rain. You won't have a season next. You wouldn't be able to bring anything anyway. Oh, says Egypt, that's okay. We just tickle a little bit of mud and the waters flow up our gullies, and our fields are therefore automatically irrigated. Oh, says God, if that's the case, then I'll bring a plague upon you. Zechariah says that, doesn't he? See, no nation is going to get away with that. You stop and think about that in reality, my dear brothers. What an incredible scene. How's your scene going? You're building your pictures? Lots of pictures, aren't there? All kinds of pictures. One after the other. But can you see that? Not a country. Not a Nepal. Not an Afghanistan. Look at all the incredible folly of that nation. These utter extremists, these violent men, driven as though they're doing something for some god. That's not the God of Israel. They don't even know who the God of Israel is. They don't know who the real living God is. They will be coming to Jerusalem. They're sitting up on their mountains and saying they're not going to come. God says they will come. The nation that won't, I will utterly waste. Powerful thing, isn't it? You know, I often think the Bible is a tremendous confrontation to the world of democracy that thinks everybody's got their own rights, they can make up their mind when they like. You know, we're not really of the spirit of democracy, are we? This is not democracy. This is autocracy in the extreme under God, under a living, compassionate, wise, and glorious God. But there won't be one nation that will be able to fool around with him like they do today.
playing politics. The United Nations, it was just an intrigue of politics, isn't it? Payoffs and all kinds of liaisons and so on. No such thing in the world then. God will speak and it will happen. Well, nations are coming. You can imagine, verse 12, that there must be many peoples that are going to undergo a conversion of the most profound and almost unbelievable form. The nations increasingly are growing against Israel, growing against Jerusalem. As we said, it was passed to the United Nations that Zionism was racialism, racism. Most amazing thing. But now, verse 12, they are all there coming. What about Germany? Do you think Germany's paid the last penny of her? I don't believe that for a minute, my dear and sister, do you? I don't believe that for a minute. Sitting there on the top of the world, they've got everything they could possibly want, roaring up the streets in their magnificent cars at 200 k's per hour, just charging through the world. That's really the German nation. Now rushing headlong to pull Europe together for its own benefit, for Europe's benefit. Come on. They can see what they're doing. And yet, that was the nation that all but exterminated the sons of Zion in an earlier generation. All but exterminated them. They paid. How do they fit into that? The nation and kingdom that will not serve thee shall perish. Profound things, aren't they? You know, Auschwitz will still be there at the time. They're preserving it, isn't it? It's an amazing thing that's been preserved. You would have thought that was the first thing that they'd bomb after the war to get rid of. It's been preserved. And it may well be a hallmark that would be brought to the attention of the world. What's this place? What happened there? And you want to go to Jerusalem, do you? And you want to see Jerusalem. Well, that's your past. You don't want to own your past. The nation says, that's all in the past. We didn't do it. Nothing to do with us. Nothing to do with you. So they sit today on the accumulation of the wealth that they obtained, because that's what they did to the Jewish people. It's an astonishing thing, isn't it? Astonishing thing. Then it says in verse 13, that the glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee. Now, Lebanon's glory is a biological glory, if we might call it that. In the tiers of the strata of beauty in growth and scenery, Lebanon scripturally is at the zenith. It's the ultimate. Just have a look at how Isaiah puts it in his 29th chapter. In the 29th chapter and verse 17 it says, is it not yet a very little while, and Lebanon shall be turned into a fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be esteemed as a forest? Lebanon, the fruitful field, and the fruitful field shall be esteemed as a forest. They will take an inversion. But the fruitful field, of course, is much better than the dry lands, isn't it? So you've got the dry lands and the desert. And then you've got the fruitful field like Carmel and Sharon. And then you've got Lebanon, which was just a spectacle of beauty with its glorious high and noble trees, its beautiful vistas, its snows upon the tops of those mountains. Well, it says in verse 13 of our chapter that the glory of Lebanon shall come unto thee. The whole scene around Jerusalem is going to be idyllic. One of our sisters has painted some beautiful pictures of that to try and portray that. Well, she's right, because verse 13 says that's what it's going to be. And some of the trees are noted there, the fir tree, the pine tree, and the box together, stately, beautiful trees that will make delightful the scene of that place. But then it says too, to beautify the place of my sanctuary, and I will make the place of my feet glorious. There's another sense in which Lebanon, therefore, will contribute to the glory of Jerusalem in a similar way to which David and Solomon saw in years gone by, when they used the timbers of those beautiful Lebanese forests to beautify the house that God would build in Jerusalem.
And in verse 14 it says, the sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee, and all they that despise thee shall bow themselves down at the soles of thy feet, and they shall call thee the city of Yahweh, the city of the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. So there are some amazing reversions going to take place. The sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee. What's that mean in real terms? You know, you've got many men that really hate Israel today. Many political leaders that despise Israel. It may well be that there's some grandsons of Himmler and Goering and other people around the world today. The depth of hatred in them, those men, is something intense. I don't know if I've ever told you a little story, but one day I had a patient, and he was German. This was a lot of years ago, when I was still in the Mitcham Shopping Centre. And I was curious about this man because his work was being paid for by a German fund. And so somewhere along the track I spoke to him about the kingdom and about the Jewish people. And there was a little puff of steam that went out of the ears. And I thought that's rather interesting. So I chatted to him for a while, and I said, do you feel that the reparations that Germany are making then are sufficient? And you know, the man absolutely blew up. I've never seen such a rage in a man. He was exactly the right age to have been very active during the war. And his wife had a business in the shopping centre. You know, that man vanished from that moment. Nobody knows what happened to him. I know where he lived. It was just 100 yards from our place. And she closed her shop and it was sold. A very active business. And to this day, I'm sure that that man was a very important person in the Nazi regime. I had never seen such behemoths. Look, you know what he said? The only thing that was wrong of the Jewish people in World War II was that Hitler never accomplished his final goal. That's what he said, standing in my own room. And he was breathing just absolute hatred of that people. There wasn't the skerrick of remorse. It was something I will never, ever forget. I'd never seen it, never known it. But you see, that's what's in the breast of a lot of European people. And that goes back to the church that's blamed the Jews for all of those things. That's where it goes back to. Boast not against the branches. They've never read Romans 11. They boasted against the branches and taught their people to be elevated against that people. And that man was just a symbol of that. You know, later on I saw pictures of the man Bormann, who was deputy to Hitler. Well, I don't know, my dear brothers and sisters, nobody ever knew what happened to Bormann, but that man looked absolutely like an old version of Bormann. In fact, there was a photo of his wife, and I'm telling you, she could well have been the lady down the street. I don't know. I've always wondered to this day. Perhaps someday we might find out. But it was a most astonishing outburst, something I've never forgotten in my life. Those type of people, or their sons and their generation that have come, they are going to come to Jerusalem. They that despise thee will bow themselves down at the soles of thy feet. But they don't do it just because they have to. They do it because they shall call thee the city of Yahweh, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. Could only be God who effects such a terrific reversal in the hearts of men. Now in the subsequent verses 15 to 18, we have Zion transformed. Zion transformed. The transformation of Zion. Whereas thou hast been forsaken and hated, and look at the expressions here, forsaken, hated, third one, so that no man went through thee, no one had any desire of thee. God says, I now will make thee an eternal majesty, a joy of many generations. Not just for yourselves, note. This is the people who before, like in verse 4, had despised that place. There's no place they want to go more than to go to Jerusalem. Got some holidays? Where will we go? Jerusalem! Who's saying that? Germans, Russians, Japanese, whoever you like. That's where they want to go. What a glorious thing this is. What a picture. I will make thee an eternal majesty. Every time you go, it's the same beautiful place, kept up in all of its majesty. And there's a joy about it. And of course, in that temple that will be established there, there will be joy. The psalms will be eloquently expressed by the musicians and singers that are in that place. And there's going to be a swirling joy around that place. People want to go there more than anywhere else. What an elevation to the minds of men. Not rushing off to their little radios to find out who won the cricket, are they? Not tearing around to find out what's the latest score of the football or something else. All of which things sort of catch the present world, catch us from time to time too. But here's a people who, and it's the world as a whole that have got the hope of Israel in their hearts. And to them it's just a joy of many generations of age after age, as the expression means in the Hebrew. And verse 16, thou shalt also suck the milk of the Gentiles, and thou shalt suck the breast of kings, the nourishment of the royal families of the earth and of the great people of the earth will be given to Jerusalem, and thou shalt know that I, Yahweh, am thy Saviour and thy Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. Isn't that lovely? Dear old Jacob's brought into the scene. The God who worked with him and all of his upsets and brought him back and gave him an expected end. He's now working again as your Saviour and thy Redeemer. And thou shalt know that. When will they know that? When the Gentiles are coming and just pouring their goodness into that place. Because they want to pour. Taxation, no trouble. We want to develop that place. What a different spirit that is. I read a very beautiful passage here. It's more than words, my words could ever say, but it is very beautiful. That's the most amazing expression of verse 16. And this is what it says. And you will suck the milk of nations, and the breast of kings you will suck. The leading idea, emphasized by being placed first and last, you will suck, is the actual enjoyment of the very best of loving personal care and nourishment. The child upon its mother, right? Milk is fat, rich cream, the best, as in a land flowing with milk. Breasts signify intimate, loving, maternal care and self-giving of the nations. Such a transformation of relationship between Zion and the erstwhile world can only be the work of God. Isn't that beautiful? It's a lovely passage indeed. Verse 17 is again speaking of great reversals. It's actually, I'm sure, based upon the days of Solomon. If you just keep your hand there and turn to 1 Kings 10, you'll see that there's an intended echo towards those days. In the 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 21 and 27, all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were of silver. It was nothing accounted of in the days of Solomon. Verse 27, and the king made silver to be in Jerusalem a stone. Cedars made he to be as the sycamore trees that are in the vale for abundance. Upgrading everything was seen in the land. And you remember that after Solomon there was a man called Rehoboam, and he wrecked it, didn't he? And he wrecked it because he sent his officers, his exactors of taxation, into the northern tribes, and they resented that. There was going to be an increase of taxation. Look at verse 17. And the second half, it says, I will also make thy officers peace, and thine exactors righteousness. So in all the administration of the kingdom, there will be wisdom and mercy and understanding and righteousness, things we've done decently. And what you saw just as a little thing in Solomon will not just dissipate away, but it will grow and grow because of the glory of the justice and righteousness of Jerusalem. Verse 18, look at the backdrop of today. Violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting nor destruction within thy borders. You know, the other day I heard an interview. It was of the man, the father of that young boy that planted that bomb that blew up, I think, something like 17 people in the shopping centre recently. And you know what he said? Oh, he said, I'm delighted that I've got such a large family. I'm just absolutely so proud of my boy. He said, I want every one of my family to grow up and to emulate his example. That's Jerusalem today. Violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting nor destruction within thy borders. But thou shalt call thy walls salvation, and thy gates praise. Salvation would be like walls about that city, and the gates would be, as it were, praise. Because people were coming in and going out of those gates, and they were exalting the name of God. This swirling sense of joy and redemption and life and praise is in that city. And it's peaceful streets inhabited by young and old, little children playing in the streets of Jerusalem. And nearby is the king that's reigning over all of that. And you take a look outside and it's just the most glorious vista everywhere you look. And here are people coming and going. Here's some from the farthest ends of the earth. And here's some Arab peoples, and they're coming with their sheep. And others are coming from way off in the new lands. And South America's there. Catholic South America. They're all there, coming. All different points, mingling with each other. And the strains of the temple are there. And Yahweh is the light of Zion. That's our final little bracket. The sun shall be no more thy light by day, neither for brightness shall the moon give light unto thee. The moon can be a very beautiful light by night, but the strange thing is it doesn't need these normal providers of light. Because Yahweh shall be unto thee an everlasting light, and thy God thy glory. Now you could believe that to be in spiritual things, and some people read it that way. But I'm rather of the opinion that this is speaking as in the earlier verses. In verse 1, arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. Verse 2 again, but Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. Seen upon thee. That's the echoes, isn't it, of the glory that was there with Moses in the wilderness over the tabernacle. And last time we referred to Isaiah chapter 4 that saw that as a glorious canopy over all the dwelling places of Jerusalem, it says in Isaiah 4. And that's what I think it's portraying here. This will be a strange life, a new life that just rests there. Imagine this, what this really means, my dear friends. Imagine what that means. How the world would be changed almost in a moment if that was the case. If there was somewhere in the world where everybody was saying, have you heard what's happening in Jerusalem? What? There's a new light there. I saw it. My sons were there last year and they told me. What would you want to do? You want to go and see it, wouldn't you? It would be the phenomenon of the world. And it wouldn't just be some little little cloud over the tabernacle, but there will be this enormous penetrating rays of God, this beaming of light in a strange and remarkable way. And men would come to realize that no longer was God a long way away. He was right there on the earth, as it were. His glory was on the earth again. And that's exactly what he's saying. Thy God, thy glory. Emphasizing it again in verse 20. The sun shall no more go down, neither shall thy moon withdraw itself. For Yahweh shall be thine everlasting light, and the days of thy mourning shall be ended. Under the glow of his influence, the sun of righteousness arising with healing, the days of mourning are gone, to be in the atmosphere of what God is doing in Jerusalem. It's going to be healing itself. It's the 21st chapter of Revelation that takes those things up again. I'll just read it. The city had no need, this is Revelation 21:23. The city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God did light in it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. And 22 verse 4, there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb. Sorry, that wasn't the verse I wanted. Verse 5, and there shall be no night there, and they need no candle, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. Spiritually, undoubtedly, there will be light. But I think also it's referring to a literal light that will be over that place. Like our pioneers painted for us in the frontispiece of Henry Sully's book, where he saw that very beautiful cloud and the glory of God shining from that. And not just from a little canvas structure or a skin structure, as in the tabernacle, or even something like Solomon's house, but a huge place, the size of the city of Adelaide, a mile by a mile. And it's going to be an increasingly wonderful thing. Are we ready for these things? Where do our hearts lie with things like that? All right, just finally in verse 21, 22. Thy people also shall be all righteous. There'll be nothing foolish hanging around Jerusalem. They shall inherit the land forever. That's, of course, straight from Psalm 37, which is straight out of the Abrahamic covenant. They shall inherit the land forever. The meek shall inherit the earth. Thy people, Jerusalem's people, shall be all righteous and inherit the land forever. I wonder if we have the temerity, my dear brothers and sisters, to be able to draw near to God with the confidence that in that verse is you and I, just members of the bright and the ecclesia, but there we are, changed and made immortal and ready to work for that whole kingdom and the king that's there. They shall inherit the land forever. All that we've talked about and learnt about since we were little children, all the things we've read in our pioneer writings which prepared us for that, have come to pass. This is what's coming. It's not some ethereal thing, is it? This is what is coming. And what's more, it's described as the branch of my planting, the shoot of my planting. That's the word of chapter 11, verse 1, when it speaks about a shoot shall grow out of the stem of Jesse. It's the very same word, and it's used only there of him in the prophecy of Isaiah. Chapter 11, verse 1. The branch of my planting. But who here is the branch of God's planting? It's not just a son, is it? It's thy people. Everything that he is, they are. Everything that they are, they've received in him. He is styled the branch that came from Jesse's roots. From Jesse's roots because it was God's planting. It was earlier than Jesse. But these altogether have been made in him. The work of God's hands. Yeah, his handiwork, says Paul in Ephesians 2 and verse 10. God's workmanship, the work of his hands. that I may be glorified. So verse 21 is surely a depiction of the saints that will be around about that place in all of its unusual glory, its amazing calm, its beauty, its song, its altogether lovely atmosphere. And in the middle of that will be this electrifying personality of the Lord Jesus Christ, emitting from his presence a most wonderful sense, an aroma, as it were, of beauty and of power and of glory and reverence to God, of mercy and encouragement, of knowledge and wisdom. And the world will be conducted in that way. And people will come and go and learn about that. They'll change all their interests. We've got to believe that, my dear brothers and sisters. Go to work, got to believe that tomorrow. Makes a tremendous challenge to our mind, doesn't it? To believe that. But what we're seeing today is just something that's going to pass. And this is what's coming. And therefore we live for that. A little one shall become a thousand, like Abraham. I called him alone and made him a nation. God so blesses. And a small one, a strong nation. I am Yahweh. I will hasten it in his time. The zeal of Yahweh shall perform that, says God in chapter 9 and verse 7, in his time. Well, I wonder what time we've got. We would really like that to be very soon, wouldn't we? I read an article just the other day too about Jerusalem and about the Jewish people, and I thought it really just has to be sometime soon. There just doesn't seem to be any other way out, does it? This was an interview of a man called Al Husseini, who was the spokesman for the Palestinians in matters to do with Jerusalem. He died just a little while ago. And he was interviewed, and the interview, you know, subsequently got out. It was given to an Arabic source, an Egyptian paper. And this is what it said. We have long-term strategic goals. We have short-term goals. The short-term goals have no relationship to the long-term. When we make an agreement with Israel and we say that we will give thus and thus, it is only stalling for time. We have no intention whatsoever to veer away from our strategic goal. Our strategic goal is to own the land of Israel from the river to the sea. And we will do that. And we don't care if it takes 1 year or 1,000 years. That is our strategic goal. Israel tried to make peace with that people, were prepared even to share Jerusalem. How do you work with people like that? We desperately need, don't we, on behalf of Israel, on behalf of the truth of God, on behalf of Isaiah chapter 60, we desperately need our Lord Jesus Christ. Only he can break that nexus. And we need it for ourselves. But meanwhile, my dear brothers and sisters, let's take the joy of that chapter with all of its inspiration and what it means to us in our personal lives. Let's take that home with us now. Bury it in our hearts. Let it live in our minds. And thus, when we awake tomorrow, we awake to another day. Thank you.